Hello and welcome back to the IEA podcast. In this episode, Director General Mark Littlewood speaks to the Honourable Tony Abbott, former Prime Minister of Australia and advisor to the UK Board of Trade. The conversation centres around the newly created UK Board of Trade and its role in delivering economic growth and prosperity. If you enjoy the podcast, please do subscribe and leave a review. You can also watch the discussion over on our YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.
I'm delighted to be joined by the Honourable Tony Abbott, who between 2013 and 2015 served as the 28th Prime Minister of Australia. He was leader of the Australian Liberal Party between 2009 and 2015 and served as a Member of Parliament in Australia for 25 years, from 1994 to 2019. During his time as Prime Minister, he successfully negotiated and concluded Australian free trade agreements with China, Japan and South Korea. Thankfully for us in Britain, he has recently accepted an appointment as an advisor on the UK's Board of Trade, where I'm sure he'll do all he can to make us here in the UK a global free trading nation. And yeah. I, for one, am delighted that Brexit Britain has begun with us warmly welcoming skilled immigrants into our country. It's fantastic to have you with us. Tony was actually born just a stone's throw from the IEA's office across the river in Lambeth, I'm told. So it's a return home for him in many ways. Tony Abbott, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm going to give you the floor for 10 minutes or so to set out your stall. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Well, Mark, thanks. It's wonderful to be here. I must say I always enjoy visiting London. To me, London is the world's greatest city because it's probably the world's premier meeting place. The best and the brightest in almost every field, good and bad, eventually find their way to London. Many of them stay. And so the first message that I've got to everyone in Britain right now is do not sell yourselves short at this time. I know that the whole Brexit thing was highly contentious. In the end, it was a narrow, though decisive, win to leave, confirmed effectively by two subsequent general elections. Nevertheless, all change brings some anxiety. That's understandable, but I am convinced that this is a change for the better for Britain. And because it's a change for the better for Britain, I'm convinced that it'll be a change for the better for the wider world. As I say, don't undersell yourselves. No country on earth has made more contribution to the modern world than this one. When you think of the mother of parliaments, the world's common language, the Industrial Revolution, the emancipation of minorities, the soft power of this country is immense. And the hard power of this country, economically and militarily, is still very considerable. So don't sell yourselves short. Now, I'm very pleased and proud to have taken on this role as an advisor with the Board of Trade. As Prime Minister, my job was not to personally negotiate free trade agreements. Obviously, ministers have some role in the actual negotiations, but essentially, negotiations are done by civil servants. My role as Prime Minister was first to impose a strict deadline on negotiations which had been meandering around aimlessly for the best part of a decade. It was to impress upon the negotiators our desire to focus on actual trade issues and not get distracted by things which are very important in their own way, but which can easily derail trade negotiations like environmental standards, labour standards, and so on. And third, to impress upon other national leaders the importance of free trade deals, not just because of the economic benefits that they potentially bring, but because of what they say about the state of the relationship between two countries and the desire of two countries to engage in much closer and deeper relations across the board. Now, globalization over the last two or three decades has brought many benefits. There is absolutely no doubt that notwithstanding the global financial crisis of 2008, notwithstanding the current coronavirus slump, materially, the world is vastly, vastly better off than it was three decades ago. But while the world overall is better off, obviously the pecking order of the countries in the world is somewhat different today than it was three decades ago. And while freer trade is undoubtedly a net economic benefit, it's not necessarily equally beneficial for all. And indeed, sometimes the outcomes of freer trade between countries can be that some groups within countries, at least in the short term, are worse off. And in a democracy, you've always got to be conscious of the social fabric. You can never be cavalier about leaving anyone entirely behind, and anyone who feels left out and betrayed by a democratic government, in a sense, diminishes the society and detracts from the social fabric that all of us, but particularly conservatives, desire to do our best to preserve and improve. It's very interesting that the British government's trade agenda, at least in the first instance, focuses on countries which have comparable standards of living and are extremely like-minded, because the upside of free trade is less clouded by the downside of free trade when you are dealing with a country that is highly like-minded and at a comparable level of economic development. And in my judgment, no two countries should find a very thoroughgoing free trade deal easier to conclude than Australia and the United Kingdom. We've got so much shared history. We've got so much in common. For the best part of 150 years, we were essentially family. I think there is still a sense of family between our two countries. I don't believe that there would be very many Australians who would come to Britain and feel themselves to be in a foreign country. And certainly I suspect there'd be very few Britons who would go to Australia and feel themselves to be in a foreign country. So the objective, I believe, of the free trade negotiators on both sides should be entirely free movement of goods without tariffs or quotas, full mutual recognition of standards and credentials, and free or at least free-ish movement of people for work, not welfare. Now, I appreciate that there might be some British farmers, for instance, who worry about being put out of business by massive imports of Australian lamb or beef. I suspect that British farmers are quite capable of holding their own, because I suspect that in many respects, there are niches that all of us can make the most of. There are particular markets that all of us have special advantages in, which will soften any downside. But what I discovered as the sponsor of free trade deals is that we do have to be pragmatic. And if it's necessary to phase in changes over 5 or 10 years, if it's necessary to cushion some of the adjustment with financial support packages, well, then I think that is normally a reasonable price to pay for getting a deal which well advances the economic well-being of both countries. Of course, Britain's objectives are not just to do a deal with Australia, it's to do swift deals with Canada, with the United States, with New Zealand, quickly followed by deals with countries like India. All credit to the British government and the negotiating team on the deal with Japan, which is not just a continuity deal, it is continuity plus. I hope that on both sides of the negotiations between Britain and Australia, the ambition is to get this done quickly. And frankly, I would set a deadline of this year, because you don't always meet deadlines, but if you don't have them, it's amazing how long things can get dragged out. But above all else, I think that Britain should be facing the future with confidence. Britain today is a vastly more dynamic country I think, a much more self-confident country than it was in the early 1970s after the winter of discontent and all of the other horrors of that time when it joined the EU. I think that Britain's relative economic performance has greatly improved over that time. I think that Europe's economic performance in many instances has declined since that time. And can I tell you that Australia does $100 billion a year worth of trade with the EU without a deal under what are essentially WTO rules. So do not be frightened of moving boldly and independently into the world on your own. No country is more capable than Britain of standing on its own two feet. And Britain's friends, who are legion around the world, will be cheering you on as you begin this very important new chapter in your national life.
Tony, thank you very much indeed for those opening remarks. And I can see there's already a swathe of questions coming in, but I warned you at the outset that I'm going to seize and abuse my privilege as the chair of this webinar and just put a couple of points to you which have been exercising me of late. Just last week, I was appointed onto the Strategic Trade Advisory Group, so I've been reading around this issue and hope I can bring some sound free market thinking to the government's approach. But I've got three questions that I want to ask you about. The first is, and you touched on this a bit with regard to agriculture, producer interests in a country. That makes, I mean, the economics of it don't get more complicated, but the politics of it get vastly more complicated. Are we best to start when we're dealing with other countries in areas where we don't have a defensive interest? The example I always give is that Britain doesn't produce wine, for example. Every time I make this point, there's always somebody from the bloody Somerset wine industry on the call who points out that we do actually produce some wine, but we don't produce much wine. It's not a big defensive interest. Whereas you're right, the lamb industry or the beef industry, this might be a lot more politically difficult to get things through. But if we're looking at a trade in which we're buying from Australia or China or India or anywhere else, stuff that we ourselves don't produce, it's a heck of a lot easier, isn't it, to get those things over the line. So should we be looking sort of sector by sector to approach those areas first where we don't have a defensive producer interest? Have you, in your experience, found it's much easier to get someone's signature on the bottom of a trade deal?
Well, I think it's important to approach trade deals not as you would approach a divorce settlement, but as you would approach a business partnership. Yes, there are competing interests, but you normally only do these deals if there is sufficient complementarity for both sides to have an interest in getting it done. And yes, there's got to be a bit of horse trading. Inevitably, you won't get all of what you want and your negotiating partner won't get all of what he wants. But in the end, the objective has got to be to do a deal, the best possible deal today. And I think it's advisable where there are difficulties to accommodate the difficulties either with a step-in, phased-in process or by establishing some resolution mechanism with a clear objective and a clear time frame for resolution. So provided there is an absolute determination to get things done, I think there's always, with goodwill, a way around. And if there is some domestic interest that really does feel aggrieved, that's where I suppose by a domestic political process of support packages of one sort or another, things have to be accommodated. Now, one thing that I think the coronavirus has certainly reminded us is that all serious countries need to retain a sovereign capacity in important areas. No country would want to see its manufacturing largely eliminated, even if it might have some short-term economic benefits to buy cheaper products from other countries. It is in everyone's long-term strategic interest to have at least some sophisticated manufacturing onshore. We've seen the downside of being 80% dependent on China for pharmaceuticals and PPE just in recent times. So I think a commitment to free trade can coexist with a determination to maintain certain sovereign strengths, but you need to approach that in a little bit more sophisticated way than simply slapping punitive tariffs on a whole range of products.
Okay, and my second question for you, Tony, was about the benefits that accrue from free trade,
yeah,
and I suppose from free trade deals, which aren't quite the same thing. But it seems to me, and I haven't gone through all the literature on this, that we tend to, or some economists suggest there's a tendency to understate the gains from trade. Mm. I think I'm right in saying that the UK-Japan deal, the official Treasury or DIT, I'm not sure which government department it is, their prediction is this will add 0.07% to GDP. Yeah. Well, nice to have, I guess, but hardly transformative. I'm conscious, I think I'm right in saying from your corner of the world, or I'm more familiar with New Zealand, enormously underestimated the actual dynamic benefits of a free trade deal, because you can work out, you know, which prices are going to fall a bit lower and that sort of thing, but you can't really work out the dynamic effects. Looking back to your time as Prime Minister, you know, how big a deal was it that you got these free trade agreements with China, Japan and South Korea? You know, are these 0.07% GDP boosts, you know, nice to have, but icing on the cake? Or are they transformative to a modern dynamic capitalist economy?
Look, the econometricians and the statisticians will argue about whether there's X billions or Y billions of benefit involved in these things. But the people who are actually in the business of importing and exporting will tell you that these things are transformative, and they open up a whole lot of opportunities. And for every one opportunity that opens, for every one prospect that beckons, further prospects and further opportunities will become apparent. I mean, these things are about lifting our horizons. They're about expanding our vision, making us aware of a whole lot of possibilities beyond the next village, so to speak. And when you think of the history of Britain, and the impact that Britain has had on the wider world in every sense, it's because for centuries, basically from the time of Henry VIII, Britain has had this global vision. Now, I'm not saying that Britain suddenly collapsed on itself when it joined the common market back in the early 1970s. Of course, Britain has been a very substantial global player since then, but there was a sense in which Britain's freedom of manoeuvre was hamstrung by the rules of the EU. And look, I certainly was not against Britain joining what looked like a free trade area back in the early 70s. But what we realised as time went by was that while for Britain this was an economic issue, for the French and the Germans in particular, it was actually a political issue. For them, it was about political union. For Britain, it was about mutual economic benefit. And I think the tension between those things got greater and greater as time went by. And I mean, just look at the way the EU has dithered and shilly-shallied about things like border protection in the face of the people movements from 2014 and onwards. It's very difficult to get 28 or 27 countries to agree on anything substantial. And why would a country that has always been one of the more decisive global players want to shackle itself in important respects by membership of something like the EU?
Okay. Now, the last question I wanted to put to you again about how you successfully approached and navigated these things in the Southern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. Would I be right to say that here in the UK or in the EU, we seem to have this approach that we've got to reach some single colossal deal in some monumental document that will sort of stand the test of time for decades to come? And a more successful approach by the Australians and the Kiwis has been, actually, you've got to keep returning to the table. that perhaps this year we can only agree A and B, and we need to return to C and D next year, and that we should approach things much more incrementally. The EU are famously, in our negotiations with them, saying, you know, nothing's agreed until everything's agreed. Well, maybe we can't agree on half of the stuff right now, but that shouldn't inhibit us, you know, trying to agree on the other half. Do we need to change our psychological approach there?
Exactly right. Look, I've taken the view to free trade and indeed everything else. You take what you can get today and you work for what you want tomorrow. And look, that's not to say that you settle for a bad deal today, but as long as the deal is a definite improvement on the status quo, let's happily take that, but put in place mechanisms to ensure that what is still desirable is worked upon and hopefully got as soon as possible.
Great. Well, we've got questions now piling up in the chat, so I will ask our audience questions through my own voice. To remind you, put your questions in the Q&A section. And even if you don't want to ask a question, or even if you have, there's a sort of democratic voting system where you can hit the thumbs up. Brilliantly, the one at the top of the list comes from an anonymous attendee. The anonymous attendee says, I am a new MP. You can see how the political class are treated in the United Kingdom, that our new MPs need to retain their anonymity. But he asks you, Tony, after your 25 years in national office, what was the biggest contribution you feel you made to improving the lives of people in poverty? Was it what you intended? And would you focus on that given your time again?
Look, it's a very good question. I think everything you do that improves the country, in the end, makes you more prosperous. Even if only makes you spiritually stronger, over time, that will help your overall effectiveness and your prosperity. And I suppose the single biggest challenge that my government faced on coming to office was uncontrolled people movements by boat from Java to Northern Australia, particularly Christmas Island. We were having illegal arrivals by boat at the rate of 50,000 a year by the middle of 2013. Some small measures put in place by the Rudd government, belatedly put in place by the Rudd government, slowed it down a touch, but then my government managed to stop it almost completely within 3 or 4 months by a range of measures, in particular by turning boats around. People said it was impossible. People said it was illegal. People said that you'd end up provoking conflict with Indonesia. But the truth is that in the long run, Indonesia's best interests were served as much as ours by preventing would-be illegal migrants coming to Indonesia to hang around waiting for a boat to Australia. So I think that was probably the single biggest contribution that I made to better outcomes in Australia. Australia is actually the only country which has dealt entirely successfully in recent times with a wave of illegal migration by sea. Britain has some problems in the English Channel right now, which seem to be getting worse. The only way to deal with them, I'm afraid, is to be prepared to be very, very firm. Very, very firm. Being firm is not the same as being cruel or unfair, because any situation which amounts to an incentive for people to take very dangerous journeys very unsafely is going to result in a lot of deaths, as well as in a lot of unhappiness in the country which is the recipient of these would-be illegal migrants.
Okay, well, I'm going to have a bit of a tempered democracy here. I'm not taking the questions that are necessarily right at the top, but there is a question that is on this sort of point, Tony, so I'm going to put this one to you. And it doesn't relate just to the immigration policy you carried out in Australia, but to your remarks earlier. Christian Nemitz, who's one of our senior research fellows here at the Institute, says, asks, do you think it's generally sensible to couple trade deals with freer movement of labour? Or is this something you would limit to countries that are exceptionally culturally similar, like Britain and Australia?
Look, I think that most trade deals should make it easier for people to move between the relevant countries. Now, obviously, a lot depends upon the nature of the deal and the nature of the country. But certainly, I think that normally there would be some element of that. The first major trade deal that Australia did in the modern era was with the United States back in 2005. And yes, there were quite generous provisions over and above the general provisions for non-citizens to go and work in the United States. And I think that's been of abiding benefit to both Australia and the United States as part of that deal. I take the general view when it comes to immigration that a country like Australia, of course, welcomes migrants, but they've got to be migrants that want to join our team. And preferably, they're going to be migrants that are going to make a contribution from day one. So if Australian business A has found person B in some other country that it believes can make a serious contribution to that business that it's prepared to employ at market wages plus something because it can't fill the job adequately with a local, well, I reckon that person is going to be a fantastic Australian if that person decides to stay. So migration for work, not welfare, I think is an unmitigated good. I think what's deeply problematic is the migration of large numbers of people who are not going to be serious economic contributors to a country that might undercut local wages, because I think that tends to lead to significant social issues. And I think all governments have a duty to try to minimise that kind of outcome. That's why immigration, yes, uncontrolled immigration, no.
Okay. Big geopolitical issue that there's a couple of questions on, so I'll take these together if that's all right, Tony. James Price asks, should free marketeers and classical liberals continue to try and integrate China into the world economic system or block them out and isolate them from the international order? And on a similar theme, Roberto White asks, what are your views on PM Morrison's tougher stance on China? More specifically, do you think that challenging China's maritime claims in the South China Sea are worth the economic impacts on local Australian industries? So one particularly Australian point, but one geopolitical question about how we should view China in the future.
Well, just to take the second question first, the fact that China tries to punish economically countries which challenge it geopolitically says something very significant about China, doesn't it? Now, it's absolutely crystal clear that what China has done in the South China Sea is against international law. It's wrong. It's a sort of a very assertive act in defiance of the rights of other countries that also have claims in that area. I think it's important to remember that China is unlike almost any other country that we deal with, in that for China, there's a sense in which almost everything is strategic. If a British business does a deal with an Australian business, the British business and the Australian business aren't particularly thinking about geopolitics. They're just thinking about how do they make life better for both of them and how do they better serve their customers and help their staff and so on. But China plays a different and, I must say, a much longer game here. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't buy things from China. I'm not saying that we shouldn't sell things to China. But I think we do have to appreciate that there is really no such thing as a private company in China. There is really no autonomy from the state in China. In the end, what the state wants, the state gets in China in a way that's not true of any liberal democracy. And what we saw at the beginning of the whole COVID crisis was that China could turn things on and off like a tap. And that means that China's presence in supply chains is much more problematic than the presence of any other country in our supply chains. And while and what made short-term economic sense a decade ago, when we thought China and the rest of the world were on converging paths, does not make sense today, when it's become much more obvious that Marxism-Leninism has reinforced traditional Chinese exceptionalism, and China is looking to exert at least a degree of hegemony, not just over its region, but over time, possibly globally. We do not want to be strategically dependent on China. Simple as that.
So in terms of us, Tony, looking for where our natural allies are, there's a few comments here about a CANZUC agreement, Canada, yeah. Australia, New Zealand, UK. Mm-hmm. One of our guests anonymously asks, do you support a CANZUC agreement? And if so, what can we do to advance this? Our good friend Ron Manners says, I'm keen to ask a question about CANZUC. We have an influential group currently holding discussions on this topic. I will be sending Tony and Mark an email offering to assist with the CANZUC process. Well, that's fantastic. It's not a question. It's an offer of help. Better still. Well,
all offers of help gladly yeah. received and most often warmly accepted.
Warmly accepted offers yeah. of help. So if yeah. any other offers of help, put those in the Q&A section as well. But what's your view, Tony, about how we could move that forward? A kind of natural gathering of nations, a hell of a lot in common, very similar economies, yeah. very similar culture. What's the big plan or strategy here?
Okay, well, again, one of the things that I think the COVID crisis has stimulated thinking on is what are the areas where you want to be self-reliant? What are the areas where you are prepared to rely on your friends? And what are the areas where you're happy enough to rely on the world? And there is absolutely no doubt that with countries that share our strategic outlook, particularly countries with which we have a long history of partnership, we should be ready for a level of cooperation, even integration, that we probably could not realistically and should not realistically have with everyone. And I certainly would look very kindly on some kind of a CANZUC partnership, although I don't think we should necessarily limit it just to Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. Why couldn't it be CANZUCs with Singapore in there? Because Singapore has certainly been a wonderful success story and would have a lot to contribute to any more integrated approach to things. I mean, we've got through closer economic relations with New Zealand, a very complete economic union. We've got obviously a strong free trade deal with the United States. We're now linked to Canada through the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Britain is hoping to accede to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think Britain will swiftly do deals with Australia. I'm sure it won't be that difficult to get a good deal with Canada. So I think we're already moving in this direction. It's also interesting that since the COVID crisis began, there have been regular Five Eyes discussions at the level of Chancellor, Finance Minister, Treasurer, whatever the title, about economic cooperation. So I think all of this is happening. And if the strategic rivalry between the United States and China intensifies, as I fear it will, if the economic difficulties brought on by our response to the coronavirus deepen, as I fear they might, I think closer cooperation, even integration between these very strong traditional allies is going to be very, very important.
Okay, I now want to take I'm delighted that the next question is the most upvoted, because it's a question from John Moynihan, who is one of the directors of the IEA Forum and is therefore one of very few people on this webinar who can fire me. So I had to take his question anyway, but fortunately it's the most democratically popular one. And this intrigues me. Also, Tony, if you don't know him, John was one of the preeminent people running the Vote Leave campaign for Brexit. He's got two questions, and this is fascinating to me. But his first is, were the recent speeches by the Prime Minister and Michael Gove saying we're heading for no deal with the European Union a bluff, so that in fact we'll be signing a deal, perhaps one that's not great for the UK, before December the 31st? And second, do you think that the government understand that whether we get a deal or not, if we don't resile now from the withdrawal agreement, the political declaration, the Northern Irish Protocol, then we'll still be controlled by EU law and the ECJ, potentially forever, not to mention having essentially transferred Northern Ireland to be a non-voting colony of the EU? Just if I can add to that before hearing your thoughts, Tony, the way this was best explained to me in terms of approaching free trade post-Brexit was that the UK has to understand it's playing multi-dimensional chess. And if we focus all of our efforts on, say, the EU chessboard and are determined not to lose a single pawn on that chessboard, it makes it a heck of a lot harder to play the chess game with the Australians or the Americans or the Japanese or the Commonwealth or whoever else, that one move on one board has impacts on the other. And if you were only to focus on one, you don't necessarily get the best mix of outcomes. So I'm slightly adding some alloy onto John's question about whether we could find ourselves in an agreement with the EU that effectively acts not necessarily as a prohibition, but as a pretty strict barrier to us opening negotiations with you guys in Australia, the Americans, or whoever else, because we've already locked ourselves into a particular regulatory handbook or legal system.
Well, I think it would be a dreadful mistake on the part of the British government to have resolved on leaving the EU, but to settle on some kind of a exit deal, which gives Britain the worst of all possible worlds, no say over what the EU does, but continued subjection to EU rules in various areas. Now, I've got to say that I am deeply sceptical that the EU will offer Britain a deal that any self-respecting country could take. Because the EU is a political project, not an economic project, and because Britain has committed the secular equivalent of apostasy by voting to leave the EU, there is absolutely no doubt that the EU will try to make an example of Britain, will try to punish Britain. So my instinct is that it will be very difficult, at least in the short term, to get a satisfactory deal. Now, I suspect that in the medium and long term, common sense and self-interest will assert themselves, and the EU will realise that it actually has more to gain from a good relationship with Britain than a distant and aloof relationship with Britain, and that given that there are currently no tariffs, no quotas, kind of regulatory restrictions and so on between Britain and the countries of the EU, better to resume that as quickly as possible, only without the elements of political integration and control. But I suspect in the short term, it will be very difficult. But look, there's been so much disruption over the last 6 months because of the coronavirus that any disruption and difficulty at Dover or Calais, I suspect, is going to be comparatively insignificant. So whatever comes, Britain will cope. And whatever comes, in the long run, I think the countries that do sensible win-win deals with Britain will do much better than those that, in a spirit of peak and, I suppose, scorned lovers try to make life difficult.
And do you just think on this point, Tony, sorry, I'm asking you a lot about our sort of domestic politics, I guess, but do you think it's possible that with regard to the EU, that when it actually comes down to it, I guess it is coming down to it about now, it might be that powerful national governments within the EU intervene and Angela Merkel or Macron or whatever say, like, for God's sake, you've got to knock some deal together. The EU institutions have approached this the wrong way. I mean, we're certainly getting those sort of noises from Germany. I don't know whether that makes a deal much more likely or indeed whether it makes the deal on the table more desirable. But is that what we'll see unfolding in the coming weeks?
Well, look, the sensible thing would be for the EU to say, look, of course, we're going to maintain a zero tariff, zero quota arrangement with Britain. Of course, we're going to maintain mutual recognition of standards and qualifications. Of course, we're going to allow at least at a certain level free-ish movement of people. It would be, I think, terrible for everyone if British citizens currently resident in the EU were turfed out, or EU citizens currently resident in Britain were made to feel unwelcome. And I'm sure as far as Britain is concerned, that will never be done. And look, because Britain has always been a country that has welcomed people who are coming for the right reasons, there's no reason why that should continue. But because Britain has committed the sin of disbelieving in the larger European project, I think it is going to be difficult for the Europeans to do what is in their own best interests in the short term. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong. And I'm sure that the Germans and the Dutch and maybe the Danes and others would like that. But I suspect the French would have a rather different view. Certainly the noises from France, as well as most of the time the noises from the EU establishment in Brussels, aren't that good.
And just to finish on the EU point, before I bring in our last couple of questions, Tony, the initial thinking was, because we had all of these agreements in place with the EU, you were mentioning, you know, frictionless trade, you know, regulatory barriers to entry, no tariffs, it should be simplicity itself to conjure up a deal that might escape us. Do you think that it might actually end up being better, easier to actually leave no deal? Or as John Moynihan suggested, he's reiterated this point, actually having to resile from some of the agreements already reached around the Northern Irish Protocol, the political declaration. And if you like, then try and build our relationship from the floor upwards rather than from the ceiling downwards. We're sort of trying to build our relationship from the ceiling downwards at the moment, aren't we?
Look, that's a fair point, a very fair point. But I suppose you've always, if in doubt, work from first principles, and no deal is better than a bad deal. And the deal that you want to do is a deal that at least preserves what you've got, but preferably improves on it. And look, if the EU are prepared to let Britain go in peace without punishment, if the EU is prepared to give Britain the same sort of arrangements that it gave Canada, wonderful, wonderful. But I just don't know whether that's the mood. And certainly, Britain is resolved to do this. It voted upon it at the referendum. The referendum result was confirmed at two subsequent general elections, resoundingly at the last general election. You've just got to get it done. For the whole thing to collapse at this point in time would be an epic failure and a national humiliation worse than Singapore, worse than Dunkirk, if it were to founder at this stage.
Okay, I wonder, there's a couple of questions I can just take. I'm conscious we're on the clock. We've only got a few minutes left. I'll try and cram a few more in. There's a couple of questions I'm going to take together here, Tony, which are a bit about sort of science and standards, really. Wow. Perhaps approaching the question from slightly different ends of the telescope. Andy Mayer asks, one reason the UK left the EU was the growing hostility in the EU bloc to science-based regulation. The precautionary approach has been added to by a sort of zero harm lobbying, which in turn means zero investment really in any new technology that is in any way difficult or controversial. Isn't there a worry that the Prime Minister, the British Prime Minister, is echoing some of that approach by talking up all the things the UK won't do in the promotion of trade? Shouldn't he instead be talking up science, innovation, the free flow of ideas and investment to drive growth? Patrick Hall asks, which I'm sort of shoehorning in a little, how do we ensure that free trade doesn't become a race to the bottom on environmental standards? If we're imposing strong environmental standards here in the UK, but then we allow in products from countries which have much lower environmental standards and are therefore cheaper, can you assuage any fears that Patrick or others might have that free trade ends up being a race to the bottom rather than a race to innovation and efficiency and to the top?
Well, to deal with the first point, I mean, you can't avoid risk without suffocating people and wrapping them up in cotton wool. Sometimes businesses fail. Sometimes accidents happen. Sometimes life doesn't work out as we would like it. And we just have to accept that that is part of living in this vale of tears. We need to be sensible and we need to do our best. But if we try to avoid all risk, we will end up avoiding all endeavour, which is a dreadful, dreadful way to be. And thank God that's never been the British spirit. Now, as for issues like environmental standards, animal welfare standards, etc., which I know a lot of people have raised in the context of free trade deals for Britain, if you're doing deals with countries like Australia, you can be confident that while our standards might marginally differ, substantially, they are the same. Australians abhor cruelty to animals, absolutely abhor cruelty to animals. We've suspended our live sheep trade, our lucrative live sheep trade, because of concerns that there may have been mistreatment of animals on a couple of voyages. We shut down our live cattle trade with Indonesia for a period because of what turned out to be largely fake news about the mistreatment of animals by small farmers in Indonesia after that arrived from Australia. So look, this idea that Australians practice cruelty to animals is absolutely nonsensical. And while our rules might differ in some small respect from Britain's, our standards would be in all meaningful respects just as high. And while Australia, under the current government, certainly will not commit to net zero emissions by 2050, we do want to reduce emissions. We absolutely want to reduce emissions. I'm not a climate change zealot the way many people are, including in this country, but my government wanted to reduce emissions. It's just that we wanted to reduce emissions in a way which didn't impose unnecessary costs on Australians, which didn't make our power system unaffordable and unreliable, which didn't drive manufacturing industry offshore any more than was already occurring. And frankly, I think all of that is self-evidently sensible. But even with those important and I think sensible caveats, we were more than ready to reduce our emissions on a per capita basis by just about the largest of any of the developed countries. And that was back in 2015. So you can be confident that at least in respect of Australia, and I would be confident in respect of Canada and probably the United States as well, that you could do a deal that focuses on trade without in some way conniving at a reduction in environmental standards or a reduction in labour standards or a reduction in animal welfare standards, because we're talking here about decent, sensible countries with very strong lobbies, quite properly, to protect animals and to protect the environment.
Okay, Let me leave you with this final question, which I think could be a sort of an upbeat one, really. This is from Saeed Kamal, our academic and research director here. Politicians often talk about the opportunities to increase exports, sell more of our stuff abroad, but don't always champion the benefits of imports, such as more choice, cheaper products and services, especially for poor families. I'm a good friend and a big fan of Liz Truss, but she definitely spends a lot of time talking about how we can sell Welsh lamb here and sell stuff from the potteries over there. How do we make the argument that imports also bring benefits and should not be seen purely in terms of trade deficits? There's two sides to this equation. Sure. And sometimes we focus perhaps too heavily on one side, the producer side.
Look, that's absolutely right. And we're all guilty of that. But nevertheless, in our lives, all of us benefit from imports. I mean, how many of you have recently drunk a bottle of wine that's come from outside the United Kingdom? How many of you drive a car that comes from outside the United Kingdom? How many of you have spent time at universities outside the United Kingdom? All of which, how many have been on holidays outside the United Kingdom? Now, you know, these are all, in a sense, imports, and they're part of what makes the modern world so wonderful. Now, there are some things that you do not want to lose. But on the other hand, there is absolutely no doubt that freedom to move, freedom to trade, freedom to share ideas has made the world of the last couple of decades so much better than anything we have ever had before. I mean, the modern world is almost indescribably better than the world of even 50 years ago. And we should be so incredibly proud of that, and we should never put that great achievement at risk.
Tony, on that important note, thank you so much for joining us. It's a great pleasure and privilege to have you back here at the Institute of Economic Affairs. We look forward here at the IA to working with you and the all of the people involved in pushing forward free trade. I mean, there does seem to be an opportunity here for the UK to rediscover its soul as a buccaneering, free trading, liberal nation. And it's absolutely fantastic that we've got you right at the heart of that, leading that charge. Thanks so much for spending some time with us here at the IA. And I hope it's not too long before we can invite you back directly in person and look at you face to face, not just over a Zoom call. But Tony, it's been fantastic to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark. A pleasure.
And just to all of our guests and participants, thanks very much for joining us. If you are not already following the IEA London YouTube channel, please go to YouTube, go to IEA London, make sure you subscribe and hit the notification bell there. Our podcasts are available at ieapodcast.podbean.com. Visit our website, iea.org.uk. And I thanked Ron Manners earlier for his offer of help and assistance. We're always willing to take help and assistance, but we're also very willingly take your donations as well. So if your help and assistance might be financial, please go to the iea.org.uk website and spare us a few pennies there. We look forward to welcoming you all back soon. Thanks again, Tony. Enjoy the rest of your day. Over and out.